And a good Tuesday morning to you. Welcome into the Nick Craig Show, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, and X. Don't forget that you can take the show with you 24/7 by checking out the podcast in your favorite podcast app. Just search for the Nick Craig Show, hit the subscribe or follow button, and you'll get a new program delivered each and every weekday morning. You can also listen online by visiting the website nickcraig.com. Well, good Tuesday morning to you. Thanks for spending some time with us here this morning. We've got what I'll call a smorgasbord of stories, all kind of all over the map this morning. However, we are going to start off in North Carolina, where last night, members of the North Carolina General Assembly, specifically the Senate, brought forth their budget recommendation. Senate Republicans outlined a 439-page proposal in their biennium budget last night. It allocates $32.6 billion worth of spending in the 25 fiscal year, which starts July 1, and $33.3 billion in the next fiscal year, which would start July 1 of 2026. We did get some various comments from members of the Senate. We'll start off with the leader of the North Carolina Senate, with Phil Berger, as he made this announcement in front of the press and had a group of individuals surrounding him yesterday, including State Senator Michael Lee, who we'll hear from in just a little bit.
Without a doubt, this is one of the fastest timelines that we've seen for pulling a budget together. I want to thank Speaker Hall for his willingness to engage at an early date on the issue of the total spend, and I think that has assisted us in getting to this point. I'm sure y'all would like to hear more details other than what I've just gone over. So the first year of the biennium, the budget is about $32.6 billion. Second year, $33.3 billion. That's modest growth, but it is growth. It allows us to replenish the rainy day fund, address our most pressing needs, including Hurricane Helene recovery, increase salaries for most state employees and teachers, and further cut taxes for all North Carolinians. We also look ahead to initiatives that will build on North Carolina's already stellar reputation among the states.
And so you can hear right there some of the more overarching issues, talking about that $32.6, the $33.3 billion in total, of more than $66 billion over the biennium as proposed right now. I think it's probably important to explain the process here, because the budget in North Carolina is if you don't follow North Carolina politics super closely, it's a little confusing. Even though both the House and the Senate are controlled by Republicans, each of them come up with a separate budget. So we saw the Senate's proposal last night. It's, as I mentioned, 439 pages, so it's a lengthy document. We'll then get a House version of the budget, which will have differences. Now, I believe what I heard from Phil Berger Jr., if I'm understanding what he said correctly, they have already agreed on a top-line number. So the number, if what he said is as I understand it, $32.6 billion will be the spend in fiscal year 25. $33.3 billion will be the spend in 2026. So that's an important piece of the equation, like that top line number. There has to be agreement between the House and the Senate as to what that top line number is going to look like. It seems like that's already been done. Then the question is, well, how do you spend the $32.6 billion? And that's where you see disagreements, and maybe disagreements is not the accurate word to use, the different priorities between the House and the Senate, because they, in fact, do have different priorities. The Senate is a much smaller governing body. The House is a much larger. The different projects, the different things that members of the General Assembly want to see spent across the state varies in between those two chambers. So the Senate was the first out of the gate yesterday. The budget includes a whole bunch of different things. Big time pay raises for public employees. I'm not going to play the full clip this morning, but it's about a 3-minute clip talking about all of the various state employees that are going to be seeing raises in some form or another over the next 2 years. Obviously, hurricane recovery, that is a major part of it. I'll have that coming up. And tax cuts. That is, of course, very relevant today. Happy April 15th to you. It is tax day once again across the United States of America. If you have not already paid Uncle Sam or requested an extension, today is your final day to do so. And in terms of tax relief in North Carolina, Senator Phil Berger mentioned that, well, the General Assembly is going to continue lowering taxes for North Carolina businesses and residents.
The finance package in the Senate budget continues our tax reform efforts that began in 2011. Since then, we have significantly reduced the tax burden on North Carolina's individuals and businesses. Beginning with the personal income tax, this body has reduced the rate from 7.98% in 2010 to the current rate of 4.25% in 2025 and 3.99% in 2026. Our proposed budget builds on these efforts by cutting the tax by 0.5% in both 2027 and 2028, leading to respective rates of 3.49% and 2.99%.
You know what I love about listening to the Republicans in the General Assembly talk about tax cuts is it truly is the dichotomy that exists politically. You look at where this state was prior to 2010, whatever year you want to use, the early aughts. You look at whatever period of time, North Carolina had one of the highest personal income tax rates in the Southeast. It was 8% or close to 8%. It was one of the highest in the South, if not the highest, in the Southeast half of the United States. At that same time that North Carolina had an 8% income tax, you had a state that was essentially broke, a state that was in debt to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars to the federal government, a state that was furloughing teachers and state employees in 2008. That was Democrat Governor Bev Perdue, the Democrat-led General Assembly. You then look at what's gone on over the last decade or so under Republican control. Taxes have continued to go down. They will continue to go down to 3.49% in 2027, under 3% in 2028, 2.99%, and long-term goals of getting the tax rate to 1.99% if revenue benchmarks are set. So not only are you and I saving more money throughout the year because we're spending less and we're paying less, rather, into the state tax system, Our personal income is taxed at a significantly lower rate in North Carolina than it had been in the past. So not only do we have more money to spend, but at the same time, the state continues to invest, right? It's not like the budget's going down. I told you the numbers. The biennium budget as proposed, $32.6 billion in the fiscal year that starts July 1 of 2025 and $33.3 billion in the next. So it's amazing. And this should be an example for individuals on the other side of the political aisle. You can continue to spend on important government programs while at the same time not burdening your populace with absurd overregulation and taxes. This is the shining example. Now, this isn't to say that everything in the budget is perfect or the Republicans haven't done anything wrong over the last decade or so that they've been in control. No, not at all. But this is an example of being fiscally responsible, being fiscally conservative with taxpayer dollars. The state continues to invest more money. The state is continuing to give raises to state employees, including teachers. We know how big of an issue that is for the left. And at the same time, you and I have more money to spend. So who's losing? Who's the loser in all of this? It's not me, right? I've got more money at the end of the year. It's not you. You've got more money at the end of the year. It's not teachers. It's not state employees. They're getting a raise. So who's the loser in all of this? The answer is nobody. And that's why it's always so frustrating when you see these tax and spend policies coming out of Democrat states and Democrat politicians. It's not the only way. There is an alternative to raising taxes and spending frivolously. You can continue to fund the state. You can continue to have a prosperous state government that funds the needs, funds the core services that they need to provide, while at the same time not screwing the individuals that are paying those taxes, right? Because that's what happens. You and I have to bear the cost of all of these state programs. So it's so great, it's so refreshing to see a government that has continued. I mean, literally for over a decade now, Republicans have been hell-bent on this mission. They have increased spending while cutting taxes, both for individuals and for businesses. It needs to be this model, this approach needs to be looked at throughout the state of North Carolina, right? We're in budget season here locally as well, where you're likely going to see discussions about tax increases locally. Why can't the local governments, across the state, regardless of your geographic area, why can they not follow some of the same approaches that our General Assembly has? Meanwhile, on top of all of this, the state is facing a $60 billion natural disaster in what was Hurricane Helene in September of last year. Right? State lawmakers, if you asked them 1 year ago today, April 15th of last year, hey, what are your priorities heading into the next year, heading into the 2 year budget cycle, hurricane, nobody knew. Well, you'd have no reason to even reference a major natural disaster because it hadn't happened yet. Even though that has happened, even though the state has already invested more than $1 billion into relief, and more money's coming, I have a clip here in a second. Even though all of that has taken place, taxes still continue to get cut. The business climate continues to be more friendly for more individuals to either start a small business, to expand their small business, or move a business to the state of North Carolina, which brings more jobs and there in turn more revenue to the state. Right, you see this the cycle there? Government lowers burdens, lowers regulation, lowers taxes, more businesses come to the state. Even though those businesses aren't paying as high of taxes, they're still paying taxes, and then the state in turn has more money to spend. It's a cycle, and it's a situation that works. And it truly is the big difference when you look at governing between the right and the left. The left says the only solution to funding government is to just jack up taxes, and it doesn't matter what the cost is. On the right, they say, well, let's just be a little bit more measured with our approach. We can walk and chew gum. We can make this a more prosperous place for our citizens at the same time continuing to fund the very important services of our state, and including dealing with unprecedented natural disasters like Hurricane Helene. Here's Senator Ralph Heiss yesterday discussing the continued investment into the western half of North Carolina.
As we've been saying since Helene struck western North Carolina back in the fall, recovery efforts are going to take time. And funding will be allocated over several bills. It is our understanding also that Governor Stein is working on another request for recovery needs, but we are not at that point yet. Thus far, we've put more than $1.4 billion towards Helene recovery, and this budget will add another $700 million into the Hurricane Helene Reserve. Of that $700 million so far, $8 million is to provide to the UNC system for Appalachian State, UNC Asheville, and Western Carolina University, and the North Carolina Arboretum to improve emergency response capabilities. $2.5 million to the community college system to aid colleges who've experienced enrollment loss after the hurricane. $5 million to the Division of Community Revitalization at the Department of Commerce, and $10 million is allocated to the Governor's Recovery Office for Western North Carolina, acronymed as GRO-NC. The remainder of the funds will be available as soon as the budget process continues and as an additional recovery needs are known. Separately, within the transportation budget, several temporary and permanent cuts were made to secure funding for the Western North Carolina recovery. Altogether, these changes will provide more than an additional $633 million over the biennium to ensure the continued recovery of Western North Carolina. Again, that is separate from the $700 million being set aside. We remain hopeful that the federal government will provide increased and expedited reimbursements, but we must prepare to fend for ourselves. Additionally, this budget also directs various state agencies to prioritize Helene-impacted counties for the consideration of certain grant programs during the biennium. Collectively, these grant programs will represent more than $750 million in this budget. These include things like the needs-based public school capital fund, the Parks and Recreation Trust Fund. This budget also directs the interest this fund earns, nearly $40 million, to be sent to the Department of Public Instruction to add funds to the Capital Recovery Fund for public school facilities programs created in the previous Helene legislation. Finally, we appropriate the $685 million in federal clean water and drinking water state revolving funds for repair and replacement of drinking water and wastewater infrastructures damaged by the hurricane.
obviously a lot to chew on there, but you know, the key highlights there include $700 million investment in recovery efforts from Hurricane Helene, $633 million in temporary and permanent repurposing of funds within the Department of Transportation, and the big thing, replenishing the Rainy Day Fund. Right, the Rainy Day Fund did not exist 15 years ago in this state. There was no Rainy Day Fund. If Hurricane Helene had impacted North Carolina in 2010, it's already a bad situation out west. It would be 1,000 times worse. So the plan here is to restore the Rainy Day Fund to $4.75 billion, where now it currently sits at $3.61 billion. So putting that money aside, because, you know, here we go. Had, of course, Helene in the western half of the state, but it won't be long until we're heading into hurricane season for the eastern half of North Carolina, which obviously deals with those threats more significantly on a more regular basis than what you saw with Helene. So, again, state lawmakers continuing to spend money, continuing to push dollars into programs and places where it's needed. In this case, it's Western North Carolina. And this is going to continue, right? There's a discussion over what the federal match is going to be looking like, how much more the feds are going to kick in. Obviously, the state doesn't have $60 billion to spend on the storm itself. That in itself is not practical. But as more money is needed, as more programs are needed, the General Assembly has already said, and it appears, I have no reason to not believe what's being said by lawmakers, they will continue to fund projects as it's needed, right? They're not going to say, well, here's $10 billion and, you know, let's just hope everybody does what they need to do. No, the General Assembly is going to allocate the money when it's necessary. The General Assembly is going to allocate the money when it is needed so that it doesn't go to waste, so that it doesn't get used improperly. And then 12, 14 months down the line, we go, well, hey, remember that $10 billion you gave us? Yeah, we pissed it all away and we still need more, right? That we've seen that process take place in the past. So a lot of emphasis there on Hurricane Helene recovery that will continue for years to come in the state of North Carolina. We'll then turn it over to State Senator Michael Lee, who, of course, represents most of us here in New Hanover County. He's also recently the Senate Majority Leader. And one of the things he announced was looking into programs within the UNC system. This is very interesting, talking about making sure that the classes and the courses offered by the UNC system essentially are providing a good return on investment. Take a listen to Senator Michael Lee yesterday.
We direct the UNC Board of Governors to review all centers and institutes across the system to identify and eliminate those that are low-performing, redundant, or in conflict with federal or state law, ensuring alignment with the system's overall vision and purpose. We also instruct the UNC Board of Governors to conduct a comprehensive review of academic programs across the UNC system with the goal of reducing costs and improving student outcomes. UNC Asheville and UNC Greensboro are exempt from this review because they actually already went through it on their own and experience significant long-term savings at both universities. We think that as we kind of move this out to the whole university system, this will enable the system to realize greater efficiencies across all the constituent institutions. And so moving on to the community college system, as everyone knows, are becoming more popular than ever before. We've seen community colleges across our state become integral partners in supporting business growth and development, and we really want to continue building on those efforts and support high-demand industries and fields. This budget will appropriate $36.5 million to increase funding for pathways related to healthcare, engineering, advanced manufacturing, trades, and transportation and information technology community colleges through the Propel NC initiative. It also will provide over $12 million over the biennium for the community college system to support the implementation of new programs in high-demand career fields that require significant startup funds. You've probably heard of these referred to as high-cost startup fund programs in the various schools. And the budget also appropriates $3.85 million in recurring funds to expand the number of colleges from 15 to 25 in the training program for students with intellectual and developmental disabilities to help them enter to the workforce. This will now have about $7.8 million in this program.
Well, there's Senator Michael Lee talking about some of the investments in education right there off the top, mentioning instructing the UNC Board of Governors to take a look at the programs, to take a look at the various departments and groups within the community college system, figure out where there's redundancies. And one of the big ones, figure out where there's programs that are no longer in compliance with federal law. I've got a story on that coming up as it relates to a different institution, not in the state of North Carolina. That is a key emphasis there. Now, one of the big pushbacks as I watched the press conference take place yesterday evening at around 5 o'clock in the General Assembly is that there is an agency within the state. I don't exactly remember what the name is. It deals with forecasting budgets, and it's a nonpartisan group that does budget forecasting within the state. They claim, this budget agency claims that this financial forecasting agency, I should say, claims that if tax cuts continue in the state of North Carolina, the state will face a huge budget deficit. And that there was probably four questions asked of Senate Leader Phil Berger about this. Oh, well, what about this analysis? What about this study? You know, you're going to bankrupt the state. This is the narrative. You can hear the narrative being spun by the left in real time. Of course, the vast majority of the media in the news, the vast majority of the media in the room yesterday being of left wing individuals that, you know, of course, hate the fact that Republicans are saying or doing anything. So with that, you had these continued questions of the Senate leader. Well, you guys are going to run out of money. You guys are going to run out of money. And you'll probably hear this narrative spun up. This is his response to this. You won't see this clip literally anywhere else. Here's Senate Leader Phil Berger.
So that's the same thing that we heard in 2013 with our first tax reduction. It's the same thing we've heard repeatedly with every tax reduction that we have proposed. And notwithstanding those cries of gloom and doom, what we have seen is the state's economy continue to grow and to flourish. And as long as the economy continues to grow, it is our belief, and our belief that is backed by our experience over the last decade and a half, that revenue to the state will be more than adequate to address the funding requirements that we have as far as the state budget is concerned.
And I'm so glad he mentioned that this has been the same thing since 2013. Every single time Republicans talk about tax cuts, and the reason that this issue exists is, as I understand it, the group that does this forecasting uses a static model to estimate revenue. And the issue you have with a static model, well, there's a couple things. A static model is easy to use because it's just one number. It's very easy to put into a formula because it's a static number, right? You take a snapshot at a period of time and that's your number. But the reality is the economy is not static, right? The state continues to grow day in and day out. And that's why, as he noted, the Senate leader noted, these static models have been wrong since 2013. Every single time Republicans have talked tax cuts, this agency, this group, and using their static model says, oh my God, you guys are going to run out of money. Or you guys are going to have a half a billion dollar deficit or $1 billion deficit with all this money, all this revenue that the state's going to lose out on. But as I mentioned earlier, right, when taxes are lowered, what do people do? Well, they have more money. So they spend more money, meaning they're paying sales tax, right, when you're buying things. When business taxes are lowered, more businesses move to the state of North Carolina. But that's more money that is being invested into the state. That's more employees that are getting a paycheck that the state is taxing. All of this stuff works in conjunction. And I'm glad Senate Leader Berger called out for the last 12 years now, the same agency has said we're going to run out of money, doom and gloom, every single time Republicans talk about cutting taxes. It's just not going to happen. And he says, we have no reason to believe that the state's economy is not going to continue to grow. And I have to agree with him, right? Have you seen anything to the contrary indicating that North Carolina's economy is going to just slam on the brakes at 60 miles an hour? I mean, there's no indication of that at all. This is we are living in a very prosperous state right now. North Carolina is the third fastest growing state in the country behind Florida and Texas. We are in a very, very lucrative situation right now. This state is absolutely freaking booming. And when you boom, well, state's going to generate more revenue, even while cutting taxes. So That's kind of the overarching rundown. There's a lot more in that 539 pages. A couple of other things that I'll just quickly highlight. Talked about some of the teacher pay increases. Talked about some of the tax cuts. The state auditor has appropriated $6 million to establish new positions within the Division of Accountability, Value, and Efficiency. That's the DAVE Act that we've talked about, similar to the DOGE work that's going on at the federal government as well. The carbon plan, which has existed for the last couple of years, the proposal would remove a 70% carbon reduction goal to preserve the power grid's reliability and affordability. Here's a big one, certificate of need. Those laws are set to be axed in the Senate budget as it stands right now. Certificate of need is government at its absolute worst. If you are a healthcare provider or a healthcare system and you want more beds, you want a new MRI machine, you want some new medical piece of equipment, you have to go to the state of North Carolina and request that equipment. Now, you're not buying it from the state of North Carolina, but you need to go to the state and get a certificate of need, meaning I need this. I need this bed. I need these beds. I need this MRI machine. I need this other machine, whatever. It is government at its absolute worst. It is government manifested to big government bureaucracy. Certificate of need has done nothing but hurt competition in the state of North Carolina. It has caused healthcare costs to skyrocket. North Carolina has one of the most expensive healthcare costs anywhere in the United States of America. There are shortages in hospitals and medical facilities all across the state, and a large part of it is certificate of need. Large healthcare systems gobble up the certificates all across the state and box small providers out of the market. That's what happens. Novant, Duke, UNC, they box everybody else out of the market by requesting these certificate of needs. Atrium, all of them are responsible for it. Then a small provider looks to come into an area and the state goes, no, I'm sorry, there's already a certificate of need out in that area. So no, we will not approve your MRI machine. We will not approve whatever sort of medical equipment you're trying to buy. There's already a certificate that exists. Certificate of need is single-handedly one of the largest reasons for healthcare costs rising in this state. And that is, at this case, in the Senate budget, is slated to be repealed, which I think is a phenomenal start move forward for lawmakers in the General Assembly. Unfortunately, NC Innovation does continue in some form. There's some changes there as well. A lot of other things. There's a great lengthy article this morning up at CarolinaJournal.com. Brianna Kramer's got it, and it really highlights and goes through all of the details within the budget in this $66 billion biennium budget from 2025 to 2027. I'll throw those links over in the show notes this morning as well. You can find those by visiting the Patreon page if you are a supporter of the show or would like to support the show financially, $5, $10 a month. You can do so by visiting patreon.com/Nick Craig. That's patreon.com/Nick Craig. You get access not only to the daily show notes, but you also get access to bonus content, including our monthly Zoom call, which will be taking place here in a couple of weeks. So make sure you are subscribed over at patreon.com/Nick Craig and appreciate everybody's support on that. We've got a lot more to get into this morning. A major announcement from NVIDIA, as they made a huge announcement as it relates to North Carolina. A major college is giving the middle finger to the Trump administration. He's retaliating back on that. Plus, CNN absolutely obliterated in an Oval Office meeting yesterday with the president of El Salvador. All of that and more coming up as the Nick Craig Show rolls on a Tuesday morning. You can be part of the show this morning, commenting live on YouTube, Rumble, and X, or send your text in at 910-377-6425. That's 910-377-6425. More coming up here in just a few minutes. You're listening to the Nick Craig Show, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, and X, and 24/7 wherever you get your podcasts. And welcome back to the Nick Craig Show, streaming live on a Tuesday morning. Thanks for being here. Turning our attention to some business news this morning. Obviously, tariffs have been a large discussion over the last couple of weeks. NVIDIA making a major announcement yesterday. The company said that it plans to produce up to $500 billion worth of AI infrastructure in the United States via its manufacturing partnerships over the next 4 years. The CEO of NVIDIA said, quote, "Adding American manufacturing helps us better meet the incredible and growing demand for AI chips and supercomputers, strengthens our supply chain, and rather boosts our resiliency." This is a big change coming here for NVIDIA. They wrote in the blog post that it has commissioned more than 1 million square foot manufacturing space. Its Blackwell AI chips have started production in a Phoenix facility, Arizona facility in Arizona, where NVIDIA is also set to partner with a couple of other companies to produce chips in the United States. And here's the key. What NVIDIA announced is that they are producing chips in the United States. For the first time ever, they will be producing chips at U.S. facilities for the first time. Right? This, you know, we see a lot of this, made in America, packaged in America, put together, assembled in America. Right? The manufacturing is not happening here. Right? It's cars are the biggest ones guilty of this. You'll see, produced in the United States, assembled in the United States. Yeah, but none of the parts are American. Right? You're taking parts from Mexico, from all over the place, and just physically putting the car together in the United States. It's not being produced. It's not being manufactured here in the U.S. And NVIDIA, they are obviously a major player in the AI space. Their chips powering a lot of the AI models that you're seeing pop up all over the place. They're announcing that they're producing those chips entirely here in the United States. And obviously, you know, this comes after President Trump announced big-time tariffs on products from Taiwan, where NVIDIA largely manufactures its graphic processing units, its GPUs, and 145% tariffs on products from China, which are going to majorly affect these big-time tech companies, NVIDIA, Apple, right? Those are the companies that we're talking about. U.S. American companies that are being hit big time with these tariffs. So NVIDIA has said, okay, we'll play your game. We're going to invest $500 billion over the next 4 years via manufacturing partnerships in the United States. This is a major announcement for the Trump administration. This is a major win for Trump and his ongoing policies. The White House put out a blog post Monday night calling NVIDIA's announcement, quote, "the Trump effect in action," end quote. When asked if there was a relationship between the announcement and Trump's tariffs, NVIDIA declined to comment. Smart move by NVIDIA. So at least with this, you know, you talk about bringing some of this production, bringing some of this manufacturing back to the U.S. This is an example of it. NVIDIA making that huge announcement yesterday. Turning our attention to some international news this morning, the president of El Salvador was in the United States yesterday. The president had a long private meeting with President Donald Trump. Then they sat down for a public question thing. You've seen this take place in the Oval Office, where the president and whoever the world dignitary is sits next to the president. They talk back and forth. And then, of course, they open it up to the entourage of media that is in the Oval Office. And then they ask a variety of questions. This was a pretty handed smackdown from Trump to CNN. Caitlin Collins, the great journalist that she is, asking a plethora of ridiculous questions. This is how it unfolded yesterday in the Oval Office. Get a listen to this.
Let's hear the question from this very low-rated anchor at CBS.
Do you plan to ask President Bukele to help return the man who your administration says was mistakenly deported? The man who was mistakenly deported to El Salvador?
Well, let me ask Pam, would you answer that question?
Sure, President. First and foremost, he was illegally in our country. He had been illegally in our country. And in 2019, two courts, an immigration court and an appellate immigration court, ruled that he was a member of MS-13 and he was illegally in our country. Right now, additional paperwork had needed to be done. That's up to El Salvador if they want to return him. That's not up to us. The Supreme Court ruled, President, that if, as El Salvador wants to return him, this is international matters, foreign affairs, if they wanted to return him, we would facilitate it, meaning provide a plane.
So will you return him, President?
And you are doing a great job. Thank you.
Wait a minute.
Can you just also respond to that question? Because, you know, it's asked by CNN, and they always ask it with a slant. Because they're totally slanted because they don't know what's happening. That's why nobody's watching them. But would you answer that question also, please?
Yes, gladly. So, as Pam mentioned, there's an illegal alien from El Salvador. So, with respect to you, he's a citizen of El Salvador. So, it's very arrogant even for American media to suggest that we would even tell El Salvador how to handle their own citizens as a starting point. As two immigration courts found that he was a member of MS-13. When President Trump declared MS-13 to be a foreign terrorist organization, that meant that he was no longer eligible under federal law, which I'm sure you know, you're very familiar with the INA, that he was no longer eligible for any form of immigration relief in the United States. So he had a deportation order that was valid, which meant that under our law, he's not even allowed to be present in the United States and had to be returned because of the foreign terrorist designation. This issue was then by a district court judge, completely inverted, and a district court judge tried to tell the administration that they had to kidnap a citizen of El Salvador and fly him back here. That issue was raised to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said the district court order was unlawful, and its main components were reversed 9-0 unanimously, stating clearly that neither Secretary of State nor the President could be compelled by anybody to forcibly retrieve a citizen of El Salvador from El Salvador.
I'm just going to stop this right here. Stephen Miller, I mean, just think, listen, you heard what Stephen Miller just said. How absurd is it that, and of course, Caitlin Collins, CNN, fake news, left-wing media, is making the claim that the United States has an obligation to return a non-U.S. citizen to the United States. The idea that any district court, hell, even the Supreme Court, has any sort of authority over other citizens of other countries is absurd. Stephen Miller saying it's ignorant for you to even ask. He's a citizen of El Salvador. Right? If El Salvador wants to handle him, well, we can help facilitate. But the idea that the United States is on the hook for a citizen of El Salvador and that a court, a district court judge, thinks that they have the authority over that is absurd. More from Stephen Miller and the gang in the Oval Office yesterday.
Again, is a member of MS-13, which, as I'm sure you understand, rapes little girls, murders women, murders children, is engaged in the most barbaric activities in the world, and I can promise you, if he was your neighbor, you would move right away.
So you don't plan but to ask
Supreme
for it,
to get it back.
Is that, what was the ruling in the Supreme Court, Steve? Was it 9-0?
Yes, it was a 9-0.
In our favor.
In our favor, against the district court ruling, saying that no district court has the power to compel the foreign policy function of the United States. As Pam said, the ruling solely stated that if this individual, at El Salvador's sole discretion, was sent back to our country, that we could deport him a second time.
Well,
no version of this legally ends up with him ever living here because he is a citizen of El Salvador. That is the president of El Salvador. Your questions about it, per the court, can only be directed to him.
I ask President Bukele, can President Bukele weigh in on this? Do you plan to return him?
Well, I'm supposedly not suggesting that I smuggle a terrorist into the United States, right? How can I return him to the United States? Like, I smuggle him into the United States, or what do I do? Of course, I'm not going to do it. It's like, the question is preposterous. How can I smuggle a terrorist?
Did you just hear what the president of El Salvador said? The question is preposterous. What do you want me to do? Smuggle him illegally into the United States? He's a freaking citizen of El Salvador. And CNN is trying to... This guy had a smile on his face the entire time. He loved listening to the media freak out over this. I'm going to roll this back just a little bit so you can hear him. How preposterous is it? You want me to smuggle this guy, this MS-13 gang member, you want me to illegally smuggle him back into the United States of America? What a ridiculous back and forth.
Well, a terrorist into the United States, right?
It's only
How can I return him to the United States? Like, I smuggle him into the United States, or what do I do? Of course, I'm not going to do it. It's like, the question is preposterous. How can I smuggle a terrorist into the United States? I don't have the power to return him to the United States.
But you can release him inside El Salvador.
Yeah, but I'm not releasing... I mean, we're not very fond of releasing terrorists into our country. I mean, we just turned the murder capital of the world into the safest country of the Western Hemisphere, and you want us to go back into the releasing criminals so we can go back to being the murder capital of the world. No, that's not going to happen.
They'd love to have a criminal, you know, released into our
country. I mean, there's a fascination.
They would love it.
They're
sick. These are sick people. Marco, do you have something to say about
it? Yeah, I mean, Stephen Eitland, I don't understand what the confusion is. This individual is a citizen of El Salvador. He was illegally in the United States and was returned to his country. That's where you deport people, back to their country of origin, except for Venezuela that wasn't refusing to take people back or places like that. I can tell you this, Mr. President, no, the foreign policy of the United States is conducted by the President of the United States, not by a court. And no court in the United States has a right to conduct the foreign policy of the United States. It's that simple. End of story.
And that's what the Supreme Court held, by the way, to Marco's point. The Supreme Court said exactly what Marco said, that no court has the authority to compel the foreign policy function of the United States. We won a case 9-0, and people like CNN are portraying it as a loss, as usual, because they want foreign terrorists in the country who kidnap women and children. But President Trump, his policy is foreign terrorists that are here illegally get expelled from the country, which, by the way, is a 90-10 issue.
Well, Mr. President, you said that if the Supreme Court said someone needed to be returned, that you would abide by that. You said that on Air Force One just a few days ago. And
how
they said
that
it must be facilitated.
Why don't you just say, isn't it wonderful that we're keeping criminals out of our country? Why can't you just say that? Why do you go over and over? And that's why nobody watches you anymore. You know, you have no credibility. Please go ahead.
President Trump.
And he's spot on there. I mean, the media, specifically outlets like CNN, and they're not the only one, MSNBC, CBS, NBC, ABC, they're all guilty of the same thing. They incessantly ask the same freaking question over and over and over again. The Supreme Court ruled on the issue 9-0. As you heard from the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, no judge, no court has any authority over national security as it relates to decisions made by the president. This guy is not a citizen of the United States. He is a citizen of El Salvador. The idea that a court could rule or decide to return him to the country in which he is not a citizen of is insane. Or as the president of El Salvador said, it is preposterous. It's a preposterous question. What would you like me to do with this guy? Smuggle him illegally across the border? When you've got the president of El Salvador, where this guy's from, laughing at the media, grinning at CNN as they ask their stupid question over and over again, that should be a pretty good indication that what you're trying to do is not working. To me, that would be a pretty good indication that the questions that I'm asking, the things that I'm constantly hitting on over and over again, the same thing that I bring up every time I can get in front of the president, probably is not a good idea. When you've got the guy who is in charge of the country where this guy's from sitting right next to the president of the Oval Office and laughing at you, literally laughing at CNN. I mean, the clip is just phenomenal. And so you've got that. You've got President Burketti saying, yeah, no, it's not going to happen. It's like the question is preposterous. He's not going to be returned to the United States. He's not a U.S. citizen. There's nobody to. There's no legal authority or legal way for me to get him back in the United States. The whole idea is just insane. But hey, CNN still has their press credentials. CNN can still waltz their way into the Oval Office. I did see yesterday the Associated Press was barred from something, which I thought was pretty funny. But I mean, this is your media. These are the individuals that are charged with, are paid to bring to the American people the ongoings in government, right? I mean, the reason that a news organization exists is because people watch it, listen to it, read it, depending on what kind of medium it is, and individuals get information, and they enjoy that information. Therefore, they have more viewers, more readers, more listeners. Therefore, they have ratings. Therefore, they can sell advertising, right? That's the cycle here. When you don't have people watching, you don't have people reading, or you don't have people listening, you can't sell ads, then you go out of business, or you have to lay people off, or you have to change what you're doing. But the media has a financial incentive to have an audience, which I'll note, they should have a financial incentive to have an audience. And then there's CNN in the Oval Office yesterday having a back and forth pissing match with Trump, Stephen Miller, Pam Bondi, Marco Rubio, and the freaking president of El Salvador over something that's already been settled, right? It's not like this is still, oh, we don't know what the decision is going to be. The Supreme Court already ruled on the issue. It's already done. It was a 9-0 unanimous ruling from the Supreme Court that the district judge, surprise, surprise, overstepped their authority. I know that comes as a huge shock to you guys. I know that you guys can't possibly wrap your head around a district judge acting out of their authority. I know that you have to suspend reality to believe that. But there you go. There's the Supreme Court saying, yeah, no, you're insane. Nope, you definitely do not have any authority over international immigration as it relates to the United States. The Supreme Court doesn't have the authority. An unelected district court judge sure as hell doesn't have the authority. We can promise you that. But CNN and other major media outlets continue down this path. Now, I'm okay with it. As Trump notes, nobody's watching CNN. Their numbers are atrocious. Their trust is in the toilet. And it's not even CNN. It's media as a whole, mainstream media as a whole. You know, Gallup constantly polls this issue. Gallup is constantly trying to figure out where trust in media is, and it's abysmally low. And for good reason. Right? When you watch it, when you just hear that back and forth exchange, which I'm sure CNN didn't air in its entirety because it made them look unbelievably stupid. But I'm when you see that back and forth take place, no wonder people don't trust the media. I mean, I think I've showed this before, but I'll bring it up again. I always keep this bookmarked because it's an important number to look at. Here's a Gallup poll from October of last year. And here are the numbers. 33% have not very much trust or confidence in mass media. 33%. 36% say none at all. And the lowest number, 31%, say they have a great deal or a fair amount of trust and confidence in mass media, such as newspapers, television, and radio, when it comes to reporting the news fully, accurately, and fairly. I mean, if this chart is not the biggest wake-up call to the media establishment in the United States, I don't know what is. Combined, you've got over 70% of people that do not have trust in media. Either in the largest number, 36%, have no trust at all, none, zero trust in what they hear from the media. And so I do find it quite astonishing that these outlets continue to act and operate in the manner that they do. I think their time is probably pretty limited. I don't think they can continue down this path for much longer. There will be a period of time where the viewership dries up to a point where they literally can't sell advertising. It is going to be very hard for their sales teams to get out and secure any sort of significant ad revenue. And when that happens, then it's over with. But as soon as you can no longer secure major advertising, then you can no longer exist as an outlet, especially somebody like CNN that has the incredibly high overhead costs that they do. Major studios in Atlanta, huge personalities making boku bucks each and every year, really, really tough for them to operate. And there's nobody to blame but themselves, right? They have backed themselves into a corner with the way in which they act. And it's funny, right? Every like 6 months, you'll see, oh, CNN says that they're going to refocus on reporting the news and providing accurate information, right? You see this all the time from these hack outlets. You see it like every 6 months or so. And then you hear the exchange in the Oval Office yesterday and you go, oh, no, okay, nothing's changed. You say, oh, no, okay, it's the same CNN that it's always been. Far left, progressive, ridiculous levels of questions and back and forth with individuals within this administration. I wish CNN was this combative with the previous guy, right? Wish CNN would ask some of these questions of the Biden administration when they were, oh, I don't know, forgiving student loan debt, even though they were told by the Supreme Court they couldn't. I don't remember Caitlin Collins and all of her wisdom nailing and trying to hammer President Joe Biden on that. I must have missed that clip. Must have not come across my feed. And so this ties in with another interesting clip that I found. Pierce Morgan Uncensored, which is a show that is produced by Fox, but runs on the Pierce Morgan Uncensored YouTube channel. Chuck Todd, former host of Meet the Press, Chunk Todd, as he used to host, he was talking about media and their coverage of Trump. And this was kind of an interesting exchange as well. And it parlays well into this ridiculous clip we just heard from CNN. So here's Piers Morgan and Chuck Todd in the panel discussing media and how they handled the Trump campaign. And what Chuck Todd actually gives some pretty decent insight for a guy that was at the tip of the spear of mainstream media coverage. Take a listen to this.
Why was the mainstream media so reluctant, it seemed to me, to go much, much harder on what everyone was seeing with their own eyes?
Well, look, I sit here and I'll defend a little bit of this in that I would argue the reason people were able to come to their own conclusion on Joe Biden is because of the media coverage. You know, look, we were subtle. He's using the back staircase. He's not using the front staircase. Hey, he's not doing any interviews. So there was this reluctance to draw the conclusion to say, is he not doing this? And that I agree with. That was held back a lot. I would argue it was also held back a lot back in the late 80s when it was clear Ronald Reagan wasn't necessarily running everything in the White House. Whether you want to call it decorum, whatever you want to call it, look, there were plenty of members of the media. I remember David Ignatius in the Washington Post, plenty of individual people questioning whether he should run. I certainly questioned whether he should run. You didn't understand, you know, there were some of that. But I understand the argument about the collective on that front. The only thing I can chalk it up to is this, whatever you want to call it, this fear that some members of the media had sometimes that they would be perceived as helping Trump if they somehow diminished Biden, right? That it was some sort of zero-sum game. Mm-hmm. And I think this has been the fundamental mistake that many members of the traditional press have done. For instance, advocating for deplatforming Donald Trump after January 6th. Look, I think January 6th was atrocious. It was awful. All those things. But to deplatform him, we're America. Defend the First Amendment. I'm going to defend the First Amendment when Donald Trump's trying to kick members out of the press. But you got to defend his First Amendment right to also talk. And I think that was also, I would argue, a mainstream media mistake. It looks more obvious today, because what did he do? He built his own information ecosystem, and now traditional media is doing what? Showing up on YouTube, right?
I mean, wow. What a clip there from Chuck Todd. I guess now that he is no longer under the guise of hosting Meet the Press and no longer having to toe the NBC line. I mean, he just completely excoriated the mainstream media. And he tried masquerading it a little bit by saying, oh, you know, it's decorum when Ronald Reagan in the 80s. Chuck, it's not the late 80s anymore. That's not relevant to the discussion. But the real thing that stuck out to me was the fact that he seemingly saw was that members of the mainstream media did not want to talk about Biden being bad because then they would be perceived as supporting Trump. They would be perceived as helping Trump, and they didn't want to do that. So what did they do in turn? Their political identity and agenda got in the way, and they decided that they were going to lie, and I use that word very intentionally, they decided they were going to lie to the American public about Joe Biden's mental acuity. They were going to lie to the public about the mental stamina of the president of the United States when he was gone for weeks at a time and we didn't see, hear anything about him. When he was falling upstairs, slipping, staring into space, walking off the wrong side of the stage, not knowing where he was, referring to people dead in an audience, talking about people that are sitting in the crowd that weren't there. I mean, they just ignored all of it. They purposefully lied to the American people to help the Democrats and to hurt the Republicans. And as Chuck Todd essentially said, they dug their own grave. And the end result ends up being Donald Trump still won, right? That's kind of the irony in all of it, is they completely flush their credibility down the toilet. They completely put themselves in a position where they are no longer trusted by the American public. Again, looking at the Gallup poll, 70%+ of people have not very much or no trust at all in traditional media. All of that, and the end result is Trump still wins. The end result is Trump is still the president of the United States. So not only did you chop your own head off to try and carry for the Democrats, but at the same time, you still lost, right? You gained nothing from it at all. You lost audiences, you lost advertisers, and now the guy that you hate the most is running the show. And now, by the way, he's also calling you out on your nonsense. He's also calling you out on the BS that you guys bring forward. Phenomenal exchange, a phenomenal analysis there from Chuck Todd, who I'm not a fan of. He was a hack host of Meet the Press. Every once in a while, he'd say something that was pretty on brand, but for the most part, it was just insanity, just complete and total nonsense. I'll throw a link to that up in the show notes there as well. And finally, this morning, we turn our attention to Harvard University. In a letter issued yesterday, lawyers for the university criticized an earlier letter from the Trump administration as it disregarded Harvard's efforts to make changes to its campus use policy to address and combat hate and bias on campus and to enhance campus safety and security measures, among other efforts. The university added that the demands from the administration, quote, invade university freedom long recognized by the Supreme Court. The letter says this, quote, it is unfortunate then that your letter disregards Harvard's effort and instead persists demands that are in contradictory to the First Amendment and invading in the university's freedom long recognized by the Supreme Court. The government's terms also circumvent Harvard's statutory rights by requiring unsupported and disruptive remedies for alleged harms that the government has not proven through mandated processes established by Congress and by law. So all of this to say what? The United States, this administration has set forth executive orders dealing with diversity, equity, and inclusion, dealing with a variety of programs within campuses across the state, universities across the country, I should say. Harvard is a major one. They were also one of the college admission scandal groups like Chapel Hill was. And so the administration has spoken against this. And with that, the Trump administration announced that they will be freezing over $2 billion in multi-year grants and contracts to Harvard University. So there you go. FAFO. Harvard, you want to essentially fly the bird to the administration? Fly the bird to the administration and to the agenda that's being set by the president? Okay. Then you're going to lose out on money. A statement from the group reads, quote, it is time for elite universities to take the problems seriously and commit to meaningful changes if they wish to continue receiving taxpayer support. The Joint Task Force to Combat Antisemitism is announcing a freeze on $2.2 billion in multi-year grants and $60 million in multi-year contract values to Harvard University. The decision comes after Harvard's president said the school would not comply with the Trump administration's demand, knowing that they will likely lose federal funding, and that's fine. I mean, I'm okay not having my federal dollars go to funding Harvard. I mean, if they receive not a single penny from the federal government ever again, I'm not going to lose any sleep. They charge enough for admissions over at Harvard. They can afford to swim by themselves. They don't need the help of my taxpayer dollars or your taxpayer dollars on this lovely April the 15th tax day to continue to exist. You guys can do whatever the hell you want, but don't expect to get money from the federal government to subsidize these insane policies that you bring out on your college campuses. These days are over. And I'm curious if Harvard's going to continue down this path, right? Because we know the Trump administration's not going to back off. We know that the policies are not going to change and Trump's not going to go, oh, it's okay. We'll change whatever we're doing. We're going to change the process. We're going to change the procedure because, you know, we really care about what's going on with Harvard. The administration couldn't care less. So that's the latest in the ongoing saga over major elite universities, diversity, equity, inclusion, as it relates to Harvard University. Well, that's going to do it for a Tuesday edition of the Nick Craig Show, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, and X, and 24/7 wherever you get your podcasts. We've got a lot that we'll be tracking throughout the day today, probably some discussions in the General Assembly about budgets. Of course, a busy day in Washington, D.C. As always, we'll have all those details coming up for you tomorrow. Happy tax day. Make sure you get those payments into old Uncle Sam. We'll be back with you here tomorrow morning.